Meeting will come to order. Representative Cornish, I assume you move your own bill, House File 3204.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to do that.
Is there any amendments to it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a delete all. It's called the DE3 amendment. If I could move that to get it in the shape I'd like it.
Representative Cornish moves the DE3 amendment to get it in the shape he wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried. Representative Cornish, present your bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, this would be a rather simple bill. It's about just a bill about glazing materials, or what you might be heard called window tinting on the windows. Back in the 1980s, this came about. They had a problem with it and started getting restrictive legislation. What I would like to have done is have this address the side and rear windows of vans and pickups and SUVs, but we've decided to keep it just simple. And what the DE3 amendment does is there's basically allows it window tinting for the side and rear windows of a police car, and then it is the original installation, because there was some funny language about where the window tinting was installed and who's responsible for it. So we have language in there to tighten it up on the original installation and replace the clause. And the other problem we had was you can, by law, get a prescription from a physician or a physician's statement that say that you could void this part of the statute where you could have window tinting. The problem was people were going in and dreaming up different type of eye ailments, and the doctor would write them out a slip saying they could have window tinting, and they were going and including their windows about 100%, and you can't see in through that, and then they didn't expire. So what we address there is a prescription or statement specifically states the minimum percentage of light transmittance that can be reduced to satisfy the prescription or medical needs. In other words, you'd have to get a real exam, and then the doctor would say, well, for this type of eye condition, you need so much restriction of the light, and they would have to put that on there, and then it would expire every 2 years. Similar to permits we get, just for example, in the DNR disability permits or crosswalk or things like that. They would have an expiration date, so it wouldn't be a never-ending permit. If the condition got better, you could go back after 2 years and get this thing written out again. So the language about first stage of manufacture, the prescription for the doctor, and then the rear and side windows exemption for a police vehicle, and that was for... It started out, somebody had a bill this year, Bud Nornis, about just canines for the care and comfort of the police dog in the back seat, and from the heat, they have to be heat regulated. So we had a bill written up for tinting the side and rear windows of a police vehicle that enclosed a canine. However, we switched that because currently the law enforcement would like an exemption. Say that they're out on surveillance and they want somebody in the back seat taking pictures or looking with binoculars, and they don't want to be observed. It's handy to have the window tinting on the side and rear windows of the police vehicle. In other words, you had a suspect or a victim in the back seat, and you really didn't want him or her recognized, and wanted to pull up and ID somebody, a suspect, so that you couldn't see into the police vehicle. And so there's a number of applications in law enforcement where we'd want the window tinting. So basically what this bill does is just tightens up the glazing material statute a little bit for law enforcement purposes, but still allows somebody to have a prescription and just not abuse the privilege. And as far as I know, I haven't had any opposition except one window tint company originally, when it first came up, the thought that we were going to restrict window tinting in general. That's all I've heard. And I've got the state patrol here, Major Michelle Tuckner, to answer any questions, technical questions.
First of all, let me ask if there's is there anybody in the audience that's in opposition to this bill? Okay, discussion then. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cornish, can you tell me on page 2, lines 2.4 and 2.5, in general terms, what the first stage manufacturer?
Representative Cornish.
I'll refer that question to Major Tuckner.
Michelle Tuckner, State Patrol. Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, members.
The first page, manufacturer, as defined in 168.011, describes the location of the actual manufacturing of that vehicle. So it's not a dealership where the vehicle passes through, but it's the place and location where the vehicle is made.
Representative Holder.
So then if I read this correctly, then you are actually fencing out dealers and repair shops, etc., because they wouldn't be a first stage manufacturer, but they, I mean, point double I would say that it was in conformance with the Federal Vehicle Safety Standard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, members, it would prevent them from installing tinting that is not in compliance with the statute, but it would not prevent them from installing tinting that is within the federal requirements.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, the way this reads is it says that the original installation was performed by a first-aid manufacturer and the original installation or replacement was in conformance. So because you have an and there, they have to meet both criteria. So you've just fenced out anybody that wants to glaze according to federal motor vehicle safety standards that is not a first stage manufacturer.
Representative Cornish.
I'm trying to interpret what Representative Holberg is getting at here. It says that the subdivision does not apply to glazing materials which have not been modified since the original installation or original replacement if the original installation was performed by a first stage manufacturer and the original installation or replacement was in conformance with the federal vehicle safety standards. It doesn't seem to prohibit the window tinters from tinting as long as they are in the within the 50-50 window tint that's required in Minnesota.
That was our intention, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Tucker. Representative Holbrook, do you have any?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think it does what they say it does, but.
Representative De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Sorry. Question for the author, Representative Cornish. The bill, as I understood it, started out as just an exemption for law enforcement to do, as I understood, what they were already doing in glazing their windows, and I have no quarrel with that. But, you know, looking at page 1, lines 5 through 7, it looks to me, and that's my question, it looks, and I have a question about why this new language is in here. It looks like this is a separate public policy issue which puts a requirement on new and used vehicle dealers with respect to reselling or selling originally cars that may be out of compliance with window tinting. Am I correctly interpreting that this is a separate issue, although it may be somewhat related to the issue of law enforcement and window tinting?
Representative Cornish.
Well, according to the revised and the researcher and I, when we worked this out, this it was clarification language here that it didn't, it doesn't grandfather, neither does it prohibit anybody that's already tinted their windows, and it's nothing new. It's clarification language in subdivision 30. You're talking about 5 through 7.
Correct.
Yep. In other words, this doesn't go back and retrospect or grandfathering in. They just wanted this for clarification language because down at the bottom it addressed motor vehicle, but it didn't talk about the specifics, sir.
Representative LaForce.
Well, thanks. So, Mr. Chairman, of course, there's no opposition here from the auto dealers that I see. I would just have a question whether or not we all, I think, have even small used car dealerships in our district. I mean, if people sell 5, 6, 8, 10 cars, I just don't know. Are they going to be in a situation where suddenly law enforcement visits one day and says, hey, you got illegal cars, you can't be selling these without some dollar denomination of modification? But I'm happy to support the bill since I don't see any opposition here.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the author. A couple weeks back, I was going up to the Minnesota Chamber event down in downtown St. Paul, and I followed this truck. And on the back of the truck was quite a bit of lettering, and I found that to be kind of a public safety concern, and I found it to be a strong distraction. I just wonder if the author had any comment on some of this lettering that we see on some of these motor vehicles, moving through the community, because I'd hate to see people getting in accidents as they're trying to call the number with concerns about the quality of service being provided.
Mr. Chairman, remember, I've seen that vehicle too, and I think he tried to do it in a way that was environmentally sound and non-reflective, so it would be hard on the eyes. So I think it was well within the requirements of the signage laws.
Representative,
Mr. Chair, Rep. Hendley, can you maybe go into a little bit of detail of what the lettering was on the back of the truck? By
well, Mr. Chair and Representative Bingham, the car was moving quite quickly, so I wasn't quite able to focus, and I was trying to dial the number, and I almost got in an accident. But
this was the quick bill. I thought. I'm not quite sure what the discussion is about or what bill, but is there any further discussion or questions on the bill? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did it pass as amended to the general register? All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Member.
Yeah, I think I'll do that. I'll have... Yeah. Steve? Representative Smith? In the interest of bipartisanship, since our vice chair isn't here, will you chair right now for my bill?
I will, yes.
Oh, okay. Mr. Temporary Chair, no, it's not a takeover by the Republicans or the committee.
Representative Molly, I'll do my best to give you a fair hearing here today.
Representative Cornish said that you were going to take up his castle doctrine, allow no testimony against it, and no vote on it except an aye.
Well, I understand that my role in function here will be to chair while you're presenting the bill. Depending on how slowly you do walk back to this chair, we might do some other business along the way.
Otherwise, I better go around this way.
Representative Molly, House File 2735 is on the agenda. Do you have a motion on that bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move House File 2735. I believe it has to be referred for passage, and that it has to be referred to the Finance Committee, I believe.
So the motion then is to recommend the 2735 be recommended to pass and be referred to Finance.
Yes, sir.
All right. Go ahead and present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that... I really have a lot of concern about it. I think it's really important, this bill, because we have a lot of incidents, especially in the Twin Cities, of people with mental illness who are seriously shot or killed because of the reactions of police officers and the way they are trained to handle most people. But some people with mental illness, it sets them off into doing the opposite of what most people would do under the circumstances. And so it's really important that police officers have some training in how to deal with people with mental problems or emotional problems. And what this bill sets forth is two different types of courses. There would be money to have the 40-hour course, which is the Memphis Crisis Intervention Team model, which is known as the best one in the country. I know Minneapolis has trained some officers that way, and some other cities, I believe. And Ms. Abderholden will explain that. But, and then the other part is to do some less intense training, but enough that we will have people on most larger forces, at least, that have training so that they can be called in, so that we don't end up with people maybe off their meds or whatever reason getting shot or killed or harmed, when a person who's trained could defuse the situation and there'd be no problem. So, I think it's a really important thing, and Ms. Abderholden will explain it further.
Fine. State your name for the record and then proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Sue Abderholden. I'm the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. First, I just want to say, and I do have some handouts, too, that have more detail about the CIT training in particular. And NAMI is a statewide grassroots organization that works to improve the lives of children and adults with mental illness and their families. And we appreciate the opportunity to talk in favor of House Bill 2735. NAMI knows all too well what happens when mental illness is untreated or undertreated, or when treatment just isn't working. Instead of a health care response, there is a criminal justice response. This happens so much that we actually have an affiliate that's just made up of individuals with mental illness who've been in the criminal justice system and their families. When there's a mental health crisis, people usually only know one number to call, and that's 911. If police are sent, this situation can quickly turn into a criminal justice matter. But if a police officer has had special training, it can in fact turn into response to a mental health crisis. If you understand that mental illness is a biological brain disorder, if you know the symptoms, if you know how to de-escalate the situation, you can just imagine how different the outcome can be. What's your reaction if someone is sharing a delusional thought? It's usually denial, right? You just say, no, that isn't happening. The FBI isn't following you. Well, that's really the wrong response. How many of you saw A Beautiful Mind? You know, the delusion that that he had was real to him, and you could talk to him all day, but he wasn't going to change the fact that that delusion was real to him. To diffuse the situation, you really have to connect to the feeling underneath. So, you know, you don't agree that maybe the FBI is following someone and that they're feeling very paranoid at the time, but you talk about how scary that can be. And, you know, when someone is very agitated, you don't come in and talk real loudly. That actually is kind of like pouring gasoline on the fire. You really talk more softly to someone, and it really does de-escalate the situation. The CIT training was developed out of Memphis in response to someone with mental illness who was shot and killed, and it really is the gold standard in the country. There was a study that came out in February that was published, and it found that CIT officers often responded to crisis in which the person with mental illness posed a risk of violence to themselves or others. The degree of force used by the officers related strongly to the person's potential for violence, but those officers used force very, very conservatively. And they also found that most of the officers resolved the issue through hospitalization. Subjects were very rarely arrested. So CIT actually promotes safety and jail diversion. The second type of training, which is a four-hour training, we actually looked at the State Council of Government, which actually has some draft recommendations for what police training should be. So it is a little bit more than kind of Mental Illness 101, but really incorporates some of the key elements that this, you know, National Council found were most appropriate. You know, over and over again, the studies have shown that the specialized training of police really turns into better outcomes. It produces the lowest rates of arrest, the highest rates for bringing in people. And the other thing is that they also found that there's decreased rates in officer injuries for mental health-related calls. We do have CIT training in Minneapolis, and Officer Steve Wickelgren is here to talk about that. Mark Anderson with the Barbara Snyder Foundation is here as well. Again, this will really go a long way to decreasing the criminalization of mental illness and keeping our community safer.
Mr. Chairman, I forgot to mention that I talked to the the president and the number two person for the Minneapolis Federation of Police, and they just thought that this was a really important thing. They see it happening, and they don't like people who are really good people and just having some type of mental problem at a time becoming harmed.
We have Officer, what's his name?
Do you have another testifier, Representative Maury?
Yes.
Okay.
Tonight.
Witness, state your name and then proceed.
Steve Wickelgren. I'm a sergeant with Minneapolis PD. I'm also with the Minnesota CIT Officers Association. I was trained in CIT in 2003, and I'm also a mental health professional myself. As far as the Minnesota CIT Officers Association, that was formed in 2006 after a number of us discovered the need that other agencies also were looking for this training, and Minneapolis PD did not want to be the sole trainers of the entire state, so the association was formed just about a year and a half ago. To date, the association has trained approximately 210 officers from mostly suburban agencies, but also including Minneapolis, St. Paul. There's been two separate classes in Rochester and Olmsted County, and also a class in Vents in Minnesota, out in Swift County. Stearns County, out in St. Cloud, is also setting up training through a grant that they have obtained. So the statewide push for this type of training is moving forward anyway. Both Rochester and Benson obtained grants through a collaboration with usually social service agencies and other mental health agencies. And in the training, it often includes correction personnel as well. I became trained while I was still working on the street as an officer, working part-time with Metro Transit. I was able to use the skills on the buses and patrolling Minneapolis and St. Paul primarily. But during that time, I was also halfway through my graduate degree in counseling psychology, so my perspective was not quite the same as other street officers. So I would like to talk about what I've heard from the street officers that we have trained. Many of them have said that either verbally or through our course evaluation sheet that we give them, that the CIT training, the 40-hour course that we provide, was the best training they received in their entire career. One officer from Northfield has worked 20 years, and he told me that this was by far the best training he had received, and that he wished he would have had this earlier in his career. There's other stories that we can talk about. Some of them are listed on the website, mncit.org. We often tell officers that it will open their eyes, learning what they have over the week, practicing the skills we give them, and we quite often tell them that they will quickly get to use these skills. And the first class in Rochester ended Friday afternoon. One of the deputies from the county was driving home from the training in his squad car, heard a call of an emotionally disturbed person, got out, handled it. When it was said and done, he emailed us that evening and said that it was rather funny how he got to incorporate the skills right away, but also noted that the call would have been handled very differently had he not had that training. And he said he didn't know how it would have ended, but needless to say, it was a successful resolution. We received many comments and evaluation forms stating that the training is good. I think our association between the trainers and the people we have presenting, we can take credit for about maybe 10% of that. The other 90% has to go to Memphis. They developed this model. We copy it. We put our own twist into it. But it is truly this model that's used nationally and now internationally that is what makes this a great success for the mentally ill. Our organization offers this 40-hour certification course, and it also can provide shorter 4-hour or 8-hour what we call awareness training. The 40-hour course is a certification course that officers must have. it's not a sit in the chair for the week and get your certificate. There is a pass-fail criteria to it.
Well, Representative Mulray and Mr. Winkelgren will go to questions if there are any from the committee. Representative Taylor, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the witness, to the testifier, you mentioned earlier you were saying that this is a training program that is statewide, and I didn't remember all of the names of the towns, but you talked about Benson, St. Cloud. I don't really recall hearing a whole lot up north. And could you just tell me very much about what the plans are for this program? What, you know, how will this go actually throughout the entire state if you are successful with this? I would just like to know how those funds will be spent and how people will be trained in other parts of the state
to
access it.
Right.
Chairman, Representative, thank you. As far as how it will be spent, I don't know. Up north, there has been interest that we received from the Moorhead area, Duluth area. Funding has always been an issue. This training is more than, as far as the cost concerns, it's cheaper than sending an officer through a week-long SWAT school. But it's more expensive than having a couple people come in and present for a week. It incorporates several instructors. We bring in live professional actors for the scenarios, which shoots this training up to the top for the officers in their careers. We also have coaches that provide feedback on these scenarios. All of these add up the cost to it. Again, it's not expensive, but it's not cheap. Based on the amount of money, we initially, through Minneapolis PD, I was donating my time if I was on duty. We had other Minneapolis officers working on Minneapolis time providing the training. With that setup, the cost of the training seemed more reasonable. But when Minneapolis said we cannot do this anymore, I would love to volunteer my time for a week up north or wherever we provide the training, but I can't afford to feed my family that way by taking off for a week, and neither can the other officers. So that drives the cost up. And again, depending on the amount of money, I'm guessing this is going to supplement what the cost would be. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mulray.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Taylor, there's two parts to this. So your smaller towns may not want to get into the 40-hour training, and that's why there's a separate 4-hour training course, which we thought might actually be used by more of the cities and towns around the state, and that's why we have two separate ones here, so that cities or towns that don't want to spend enough to have the 40-hour course could apply for the 4-hour course, which can be certified.
Any other questions for Mrs. Taylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just wanted to comment that I think when we're, you know, spending statewide dollars, I just always want to make sure that those opportunities do exist for the training, because so often when you're considering, it's not just the cost of training the person, but all that, the trip down, the overnight, all those sorts of things, which tends to lead those law enforcement agencies in outstate Minnesota a little, even more at a loss, not able to access these sorts of training. So I wanted to be certain that within this bill there was provision made so that it really would be statewide and not just for those that are close enough to drive. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, and my background is as a licensed psychologist, and I've worked in corrections for a lot of years, and currently I serve as a hearing officer at the Ramsey County Workhouse. We have about 450 inmates, and I'd say about 20% have significant mental health issues, and we've done some training along the same lines to our officers that you're suggesting here, and we found it to be tremendously positive and successful in terms of de-escalating and managing some of the difficult issues that arise with some of these troubled folks. So I just heartily endorse this kind of training, particularly for line staff, to give them a better handle and understanding and context to manage these folks in a more effective way. So it's a good bill.
Thank you. Any other questions from any other committee members? If not, Representative Morley, do you have any other... Representative Holberg, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is this would not be a mandate to all police officers. It would go to the post board for grants available statewide.
Representative Mallory.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg.
All right, thank you.
Representative Mallory, do you have any other testifiers?
No, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience wishing to be heard on House File 2735? Raise your hand. We do. I see one hand. All right, sir, would you come forward?
Oh, Mark Anderson. Mark, Mr. Chairman, Mark Anderson. He's with a foundation that was set up because of somebody who was shot, I believe, and I think killed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you for hearing this bill. This is so important. June 12th, 2000, Barbara Schneider was in a mental health crisis in South Minneapolis, and there was a 911 call went in. It was a noise complaint call, and officers responded, and there was a physical confrontation. She lost her life. That's how we got involved. We created the Barbara Schneider Foundation. Immediately began talking to leadership, Minneapolis Police Department. As Sergeant Wickelgren said, they sent the delegation down to Memphis and rolled out this program a year later. It really, partly in response to Barbara's death, but some other incidents as well. I would just add, not repeating what's already been said, but just to add that the CIT training provides a wonderful forum in a local community for police officers to connect with their emergency medicine, with their social services, both the nonprofit and the county, with their mental health providers, and to develop partnerships and collaborations with their courts people and their corrections about how to work with this population that's at risk. It's a great way. In terms of the funding issues, I know you're concerned about that. What the Sergeant Wickelgren said is really true, that cost is really a barrier for local police departments. There's a lot that would like to get this. They need a little bit of help. We're out there raising in the community, raising money to help underwrite this type of training. Some help from the state, I think, would be appropriate and greatly appreciated.
Any questions of this witness? If not, before we proceed, I would just like to recognize a group in our audience today. They're participating in the Minnesota Historical Society Capital Historic Sites Voice of the People World War in Minnesota Government Tour and Educational Program. The ninth grade students from Kirkhoven Murdoch Sunberg High School. Welcome to this committee. And with that, is there any further or any discussion on House File 2735? If not, it's before us on a motion that it be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. Any discussion? If not, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Recommended to pass. Thank you.
Representative Lilly may have a motion to replace our vice chair with
Representative Kalin, that sounds better than the other one, which was Representative Cornish said he wanted to chair, and I thought about the way he might handle a disagreeable member or something with firearms or something.
I believe Representative Cornish would think that this committee was his castle.
What is it? Okay. House File 2141. Hmm? I don't know who will. Does someone want to move this still? Representative Johnson, you'll move the bill? Okay. Representative Johnson moves House Bill 2141. Is there any amendments, Representative Dominguez?
Mr. Chair, there's no amendments.
No amendments. Okay. Representative Dominguez, go ahead with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you, Sheldon, for moving the bill today. House File Number 2141 is a bill that relates to landlord and tenants. It's requiring expungement of court eviction records after 1 year. Mr. Chair and committee members, I have a couple folks here that are going to testify on behalf of the bill, but I just want to say a few words about House File 2141. House File 2141 is a bill that right now it stands at 5 years, which is the expungement. We want to bring it down to 1 year. And why I say that is 1 year is because I think that's a sufficient amount of time that folks can get their act together. The courts are notified. The folks that are renting the property still need to do background checks. Everything is in place. The only thing that's not in place is that they have to wait for 5 years to get this expunged. Many communities today are in need of this bill because of a lot of homeless that are in the communities. A lot of the folks that we're working with have lawful detainers. And what those lawful detainers means is that they cannot get apartments because it's on their record. And so they're out in the streets. They're out in the shelters with family members, a lot of moms with kids that may have gotten into some domestic abuses, and trying to get their lives together. But what's hanging over their heads is this lawful detainers. And so today you're going to hear about some of those issues. And I bring this bill today because, especially in Minneapolis, where we're seeing a lot of foreclosures and a lot of property that is being boarded up, a lot of those issues pertaining to a lot of communities nowadays. But we're having a problem with foreclosures, and those lawful detainers are being put upon folks that have once rent in those apartments. And so they're having those kind of problems right now. And so 5 years, I think it's way out of proportion. I think we should bring it down to a year. And so that was just some of the reasons why I think this is a very good a bill. And again, I'm going to turn it over to the folks that are going to testify, Mr. Chair. I have one testifier here right now, and he can say his name.
Representative Dominguez, as you heard last night, the other bill, which is going to pass, I think it's carried by either Representative Coles, who's not here, or Representative Dabney, is taking care of detainers for foreclosures where the renter hasn't done anything wrong, where the bank is just doing it. So that's going to pass and become law. I think there's no question. So that takes care of one of the arguments you had for this. But we can go to your testimony.
Let me just respond real quickly, Mr. Chair. I think that you may be correct in some sense, but I also... I think there's differences here that we're talking about. I think we're talking about folks that have lawful detainers already. We're talking about folks that have money to get into departments, but again, they have these lawful detainers. We're talking about a lot of families here.
Well, Representative Dominguez, we can get into it, but I don't want to get confusing different issues. And the one, that's a different issue from whether it's because of the foreclosures. If there's other ones, then I just want to make clear to the committee there's two different issues here, and one is being dealt with in a different bill.
Mr. Chair, but I did not bring that up. You brought it up.
Well, you had stated it, Representative Dominguez, so...
my name is Jerome Love. I'm with the United Citizens Commission. And
I have been working on...
Sir, you have to use Jerome what?
Love.
L-O-V-E.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Now, I have been working on this for about 11 years. I first started with Needham Walker, State Representative Needham Walker. And one of the reasons that I got into this, because I'm a retired school teacher. And one day when I was working with one of the after-school programs, this young lady, she was about maybe 7 or 8, she didn't want to go home due to the fact that she didn't have a home, and I didn't realize that. And the young lady, she said, "Mama, where are we going to stay at tonight?" She said, and then she didn't want me to know that she didn't have a place to stay. She said, "I don't know, baby, we'll find some place, somebody take us in." And I said, "Are you homeless?" She said, "Yes, curse these damn UDs." I said, "What is a UD?" She said, "That's what a landlord can put on you when you don't pay your rent or when you don't want to have anything to do with him." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He gave her a UD, an unlawful detainer, because she wouldn't be intimate with him. This was just one of the incidents that made me get involved in this. The second incident was 4 months later. This young lady, her and her 4 children, they were on the street. And she had an 8-month-old baby. They was in a domestic crisis, and it was very, very cold. And unfortunately, this 8-month-old baby, you know, like some Christian person, family took them in. But it was too late. The 8-month-old baby died. And I realized the seriousness of this problem then. And since then, I have been fighting adamantly to get this bill, this UD law change. And if you will bear with me for a few minutes, I will share with you what I'm, where I'm coming from. And I want to thank all of you for taking the time to even listen to me. First of all, this is one of the most important decisions as, to me, one of the most important decisions of the century, because this is an opportunity to change a diabolical law that have crippled hundreds of thousands of unsuspecting people. And this curse or plague is this UD law that is in itself a direct violation of our constitutional rights under the 14th Amendment. Now, this law has got to be changed, and we are in a position to change this right now. Now, this particular bill that my brother here have taken over from Keith to keep it going is the UD Amnesty Bill. Now, you say, what is the UD Amnesty Bill? Well, the UD Amnesty Bill is a bill that was authored by Congressman Keith Ellison, who was state representative at that time, and State Representative Neva Walker, State Representative Karen Clark, Senator Linda Bergman, and Senator Linda Higgins. Now, this bill expunges the records from this UD because it's evil to punish somebody for 7 to 10 years because they can't pay their rent, or somebody called and say that they have a bunch of people coming over. Or just like when the buses was on strike for 44 days, all of these people lost their jobs, and so many people lost their jobs, and as a result, they lost their apartments. But, you know, like, it wasn't no fault of their own, but yet and still they were punished for it. Now, if you would just bear with me for a few minutes more, I would share with you.
We're going to have to, because of the time limit we've got.
This is just as important as any other law that you were speaking of, sir. You talking about Joe, you know for a fact that this is important. You can't punish people 7 to 10 years because of the fact they can't pay their rent. And if I can be allowed just 3 more minutes, and I would be away from in front of you. If I can get 3 minutes from you, sir.
Okay, but Representative Dominguez, he'll be your witness then, because we have to get to the con bill also today. And
okay.
If you will allow me,
for one thing, I want to share with you, this UD law is in itself, it's in itself wrong, and like I said earlier, it's a direct violation of our constitutional rights. And do you know how many people get UDs every year? I mean, just the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority gives over 10,000 UDs a year. And all of these other people give UDs. Now, the reason that I am so adamant about this is because of the fact that
You know, and I know, if you couldn't pay your rent, you're going to be punished for 7 to 10 years because you lost your job or you wasn't able to get an apartment. That is wrong. And we have an opportunity now. We've been working on this for 10 years to get an opportunity to get this UB amnesty bill passed. And we need this passed because it is crippling and is destroying so many hundreds of thousands of families. Tom Hay, who was my mentor, he asked the people to close to show me the records. And for the last 10 years, just from 1998 to 2008, we have over 100,000 UDs that have been put on people. People that, because of no fault of their own, they were given a UD. So this is a bad deal. And to, a 1 year, I think, is enough time to punish somebody because they lost their job or because of the fact that their job closed up and went to another state or because of the fact that they did something that caused them to have to move. And if I'm out of place, please forgive me, but I want you to see the seriousness of people dying, people sleeping on the streets because they got a UD, they can't get an apartment. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have to go to the opposition on this. Is there any opposition? Representative Mingus, we're trying to get equal time in here on for people. So if we'll take the opposition then now. And
what about the up testimony?
Okay, we'll give you 1 minute. We'll give your other witness 1 minute.
I think it's important to do this for a couple reasons. I've done many different things in the state of Minnesota. I've been a social worker, I've been a teacher. Family's been here for 5 generations. Okay? My parents, Eugene McCarthy, Democrat, and a Republican mayor in northern Minnesota. I try to find my bearings on these issues, and I'll tell you what. Don't do anything different. We don't have to. We had this conversation 3 years ago. Nobody would listen. Now we have a predatory lending problem of immense proportions. We have a homeless issue that cost us $20 million in the state of Minnesota on the government's plan. But keep doing more of the same. You can expect to have more problems. North Minneapolis, 17% of the people voted in the last election at the local level. Not because they don't care about things, just because they've lost faith in what the government is doing. We can make a fiscal conservancy argument here. We can say it's a lot cheaper to do something now and to help provide some remedy for people in the short term, or we can sit back and pretend that in the short term we're acting by being tough and acting on behalf of the landlords. You know, some landlords are good, some are bad. I can tell you right now, if you believe that people have equal redress under the law and equal access, you must be living in a different country than I am. I mean, I don't understand all the arguments keep being made. 8 years I worked as a social worker. And I'll tell you what, in 8 years I never won.
We have to try and give some equal time.
For the time. Thank you, members. We didn't want to get carried away, but this
you
is
might want to sit close up so that you can, for questions afterwards. Mr. Horner, and then I don't know who that is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Can we get Representative Dominguez the chair there? Or, okay.
Thank you, Mr.
Horner, state your name for the record.
Jack Horner, representing Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. And also, Mr. Chairman, I have with me Mark Otness, who's actually our incoming president of our association and a longtime owner, manager of apartments in the metro area in the state and a family-owned apartment business. And he's here to testify and, of course, both of us for any questions. Our comments are brief. Evictions are one of the key pieces of information that landlords use. They have to, are encouraged, in fact, required by some cities to screen residents. They're encouraged by the police to screen residents. They're encouraged by organizations that are interested in community welfare to screen the residents. And rental history and evictions are one of the primary pieces of information that they use. Renting is a credit transaction according to the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, and past performance is considered a primary indicator of future activity. Good credit practice requires that you rent to customers who are able and willing to pay the rent, and this is a primary way of avoiding foreclosure. I mean, if you have customers in who can pay the rent, you're much less likely to be forced into foreclosure and abandoning particularly a small rental property. Secondly, the rental history is critical for determining whether a resident is going to be a good addition to a community, whether he's going to be a good addition to that building, that he doesn't have a history of crimes or damaging the property or of nuisance violations, reasons why, along with non-payment, why people are evicted. There are many safeguards currently in law. Chairman Mullery mentioned a bill that's going to pass. In addition to that, there's the general expungement statute that allows expungements, a expedited procedure for people who did get unfairly evicted, and the record should not show that. Finally, let me just say that in addition to cities and police who work with landlords who encourage screening and encourage looking into records, particularly expungements, expunging these judicial records is kind of contrary, first of all, to the Supreme Court's rules of public access to records, which requires that the court set up indices available to access for judgments, which are good for 10 years, case law or trial indices, party indices, so that people have access to these public documents and see what the courts are doing and see how the courts have held in various cases. I think that's the gist of our argument, and if there's any questions, I'd certainly be happy to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Horner, for making it short. Did you want to testify or answer questions? Or?
Yes, why don't I just amplify a couple points. My name is Mark Otten, as Jack mentioned. I am the incoming president of the Multi-Housing Association for this coming year, and I manage about 1,200 apartment units, primarily in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. I also have one up in Duluth, one down in Northfield. But I do have buildings in both the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. We run reputable, stable buildings in behalf of our long-term residents. We think that is profitable over the long term. And we run at buildings that are really assets to the neighborhood. The key to having a good building is to really have good residents. You live and die on it. If you have bad residents, nothing goes right. If you have good residents, things go right. You still have to provide good services, but one bad apple really does spoil the bunch. And I've seen that repeatedly. You can have a building where you have 50 apartments, but you have one that's bad, and it affects the entire building, and you lose residents if you don't take care of it. It's not only issues, it's damage to the apartments, it's the noise, it's everything. And in order to do that, is really screening is critical. And we use all the pieces that we can get a hold of, one of which is definitely the eviction records. Oftentimes, we find that the past is the future. If someone has these things in the past, that makes it more likely that it would be difficult going forward. It's not as if, we will make exceptions. We'll listen to people's stories. But it is a critical piece of information that we have to have without a restriction. Thank you.
We need to wrap it up.
Oh, sure. Yes.
I let Representative Dominguez's witnesses went quite a bit on, but I hope you'll bear with us for we have to go on, and because we've got another important bill we have to get out. Representative De La Forest.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, I'll ask one question of Mr. Horner. This file, House File 2141, says that the expungement must happen within 1 year of the action being commenced, which I find rather curious. But in a typical jurisdiction in the metro, say Hennepin County or Dakota County, how long can it take to adjudicate one of these actions? Because that, of course, is going to fall within the one-year window.
Mr. Horner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Forrest, the statute provides that the case be set between 7 and 14 days from the date of filing the complaint, so it is rather quick.
Okay.
Representative Westrum.
Mr. Chair, I guess Representative Dominguez, your first witness, sounds to me like we've got a more serious problem than dealing with UDs, but how would a landlord avoid getting another person in that's not going to pay the rent or not going to act in a manner that they would want if we're going to take this off the record. That's a huge way for the landlords to make that determination. And if they bring somebody in that they would have been able to find out maybe didn't have the great record, they're going to be in trouble with a lot of their other tenants who are going to be mad that the landlord brought this person in. And so it seems to me like a real quagmire that you could be creating bigger, more problems by your solution. But my question is, in the first witness you had, he said because the landlord wouldn't, the tenant wouldn't have a relationship with the landlord, they put a UD against him. It seems to me if that's the case, we got a bigger problem in our courts than you do, because that's against the law right now, or is it not? Can you have a UD filed against you for a landlord alleging they won't have a relationship so they can kick them out? Mr. Horner, maybe you know the answer to this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rester Horner, obviously it is against the law. There are some rather spectacularly large awards under discrimination law. Fortunately, there are not many. Fortunately, it doesn't happen very often. It has happened, and it's tragic, and it shouldn't happen, and of course, it's clearly against the law that that would happen. A landlord threatening a tenant with sexual harassment.
To that point, Mr. Chair, I would just encourage through legal aid or something else, if that's the reason the court granted the UD, Representative Dominguez, I think that's a whole separate issue than UD, because that's against the law right now, and some judge is not following the law. That's the way it's going.
Mr. Chair, Representative Easton, I think you're correct in saying that we would have had someone here from legal aid, Ron Elwood, but he's testifying right now on the Senate side. That's why he couldn't make it, and he probably could give you a better answer to the question. What we're experiencing, and I will speak for the north side of Minneapolis, we are experiencing some of those issues, and it's been an ongoing issue. It's not just happening today, but it's been going on from the history of the north side of Minneapolis. We have a lot of rental property on the north side of Minneapolis, so there's tons of issues there that it probably should be going to the courts also, and you're correct in saying that.
Mr. Gehring, I have a question. It seems to me like not this. First of all, it takes away the discretion of the court on an expungement, but second of all, it seems to me like there aren't exceptions. If I go into Representative Cornish's apartment and I intentionally damage it, other than him shooting me for it, after a year, there's no consequence to that. Is that pretty much what... am I misreading this or something?
Mr. Chair, the language in the bill provides that all court records of an eviction action be expunged, and there's no discretion for the court in terms of expunging records of an eviction. Now, I guess if you're in a situation where the landlord brought a separate suit for damages or some other type of action that is not specifically an eviction action against you for damaging the property, I don't think that would be covered by this language, but anything that is related to the eviction record or the eviction action would be required under this bill to be expunged.
But having been, I used to be on the housing court committee for Hennepin for a long time, and a lot of times they didn't bother to bring actions for other things, because they knew they wouldn't collect. Is that correct, Mr. Horner?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Yes, I was on. In fact, I was the one that set up the Housing Court Committee for Hennepin. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Partially by way of answering Representative Weston's question on what can you go down and file for. Representative Weston, you could go down to the courthouse right now
and file a UD against me if you wanted to. And it's true that, yes, anyone can file a UD against anyone. And that's part of the issue, is that, in fact, most of these people, when a tenant check is run on them, you go and you check filings, not actual judgments, because an unlawful detainer is an action to regain the premises because it's being unlawfully held based on some material breach of the lease up to and including non-payment of rent. However, unless you went down and filed the UD against me in some way that would violate my civil rights, there's very little in the way of recourse that I would have against you. But my question is for the testifiers, Mr. Otness and Mr. Horner. The proposal for Representative Dominguez is that these things go away after a year. In either of your opinions, in opposition to the bill, is there an appropriate amount of time that you think there should be after which these things should be expunged, including not just the judgments and the filings? And if not, do you think it should just stay on there forever?
Mr. Horner.
The Chairman, Representative Leitch, I think the current law is what we should maintain. I think it's working well. They're regulated by the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which considers renting a credit. Generally speaking, all credit information in this category has a 7-year requirement. Some of them, bankruptcies are 10 years. State court judgments are 10 years, as we all know.
We're not going to allow comments from the audience when... I'm sorry, Mr. Horner.
So I think it's important to remain uniformity, not only with the federal law and with the other states, but also with credit information in general that is available. This is the way the courts run their record systems. The information is not available forever, just by definition, because the courts all have record retention policies and they periodically clean them out. But you do need to go back quite a number of years sometimes to see a history of nuisance behavior, of criminal behavior, of non-payment of rent. You don't want someone to be continually, over several years, being able to damage property or not pay the rent or cause nuisance behavior and then simply move a couple of blocks away because you weren't ever able to find out this history. So we think the current law, which has been in place for a long, long time, seems to be just fine.
Representative Tamar.
Quickly, Mr. Chair, I am sympathetic to Representative Dominguez's bill and what he's trying to get at, I should say. And I don't know if we can resolve this today, but in looking at 484014, the expungement of housing records, it would seem to me it would be very difficult for a tenant to get their record expunged. And I'm just thinking, you know, what if someone didn't damage property but rather fell on hard economic times and missed paying their rent and was evicted? I mean, should they be punished in perpetuity and not be able to ever rent an apartment again? I mean, it doesn't seem like you could actually, the court would ever grant you grant your request to have it expunged, if I'm reading the statute correctly. Mr. Horner, I don't know if you know the issue better than I do.
Mr. Horner?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Also, Mr. Otten has had just a couple of things. First of all, credit information, regardless of evictions, in the case that you described, Representative Tamar, is available for a long period of time, whether through credit records, whether through court judgments. People do undergo hard patches, that's right. And so if you're applying for a loan, for example, and you lost your job a few years ago, you might have to say, well, you know, you're going to find some bad credit, you're going to find some judgments, but here's what happened, and I've been now working for several years, or whatever it is. And it's the same with evictions. If someone was evicted, I don't know of any landlord in this town that can give his own personal experiences who wouldn't say that it looks to me like even though you had a tough go several years ago, that you certainly are a good resident now. I mean, landlords are in the business of doing business. They want to do business. They're looking for good customers. They're looking for ways to do business, not for ways to disqualify people like anyone in business.
Yeah, just briefly, we will look at all information that we get, but as it recedes in time, it may become less important, you know, especially if there's a good record after that. When we do see them, we will ask our applicants about them.
and there have been cases where we disregard it, either because there was an oddball reason why it happened. Sometimes we'll talk to the prior landlord and we'll find out what happened there. But just like credit information, income information, this is really critical for us to make a decision to have a stable building. Having a bad resident in is disruptive to other residents. It's disruptive and financially damaging to me. If you have someone that moves out after really trashing a unit, it takes you a long time to recover.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I need to get back to, like, not lawyerese here. Somebody explain a few things to me. The prior testifier talked about housing agencies just handing out UDs, 10,000 UDs handed out. Isn't there a judicial process before you actually have that on your record?
Mr. Chairman,
that's a simple one I can answer.
Certainly you have to prove up a case, you have to have a good case, you have to prove it. It's certainly true.
And Mr. Chair, if there is something filed against you and it's found to be, they can't prove it to be true, then is it always said on your record that it was filed but not, you were not found guilty, or... Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't agree with the bill. There might be some problems. And then my second question, and certainly staff or whoever, could this, are there instances where under this process somebody's evicted for behavior that could be, could threaten the public safety? In other words, could somebody be evicted for some kind of behavior where if a year later you didn't know about it could actually put other tenants in at risk in a building?
Mr. Horner?
Thank you, Mr.
Let me answer. What we get on the back of the suits is our eviction filings. Oftentimes we don't get the result of what results in a unlawful detainer eviction. And for even people that don't pay the rent, who have very disruptive behavior, it seldom goes to judgment because you have the 2-week period after you file to move out. And if you move out, there's not a court hearing. Or if there's a settlement where they agree to move out, there's not a court hearing. So there is an opportunity where if there's just a filing that we will, you know, look into it, or they'll, you know, they may have some explaining to do. But we do look at the fact that there has, that a prior landlord has gone to make a filing.
Mr. Chairman, one other comment. Tenant screening agencies and credit reporting companies are required by statute to state the outcome of an unlawful detainer when that outcome is available, when it's on the court record. They are required by current law to state the outcome. And secondly, there is a coding system in place that the courts can use with numerical indicators of what the unlawful detainer was for. So the concept is to make them as reliable and as trustworthy information as possible to both parties.
Okay. Oh, is this up or?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Just by way of comment, I think we've discussed a lot about the aspect of these unlawful detainers, and I think it is a topic that needs to be discussed more in terms of, because as has been stated by the testifiers, what we're looking at here is filings primarily, not just judgments levied against people. And anyone can go in and file at any time. When you collect up too many of these, no one's ever going to rent to you. That said, 1 year, I think, is really, really soon. I would be concerned if someone was able to keep themselves from getting filed against for a year, but they had a glut of these things older than a year. I would certainly want to know that as a landlord. So just for purposes of the bill discussing it, we're talking about the year deadline, and I think that's pretty quick.
Representative,
I'll pass, Mr. Chairman. Looking at the time.
Thank you. Somebody is. Okay, it looks like we're ready to vote on this. All in favor of the bill, say aye.
Mr. Chair,
all in opposed, no.
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 No. It fails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn, can you do your vote very quickly? Representative Kahn. Would somebody, Representative Lilly, do you want to move this bill? No?
I'll move it.
Okay. Representative Hellstrom. Representative Hellstrom moved the House File 2168. Representative Kahn, can you...
Sam, we have to go very quickly, Mr. Chairman. This bill passed unanimously through the Agriculture Committee. It passed in an earlier life. It once passed the Senate on a 60-nothing vote. It then got bogged down, I think, in this committee with Representative Stanek, but it did pass through actions of Representative Crinkley and myself. It did a version of it did actually pass the House and was an action of Governor Ventura at that time. I'd like to speak very briefly to Dr. Wagland from the University of Minnesota, who's been working on hemp, industrial hemp research, and has also been working with law enforcement.
Thank you, Dr. Wagland.
It's, Dr. Weibland from University of Minnesota, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill. I became involved with research on cannabis genetics following the call of the state legislature to investigate the economic potential of industrial hemp as a crop alternative for Minnesota farmers. And I've been a Drug Enforcement Administration registered researcher since 2002, studying the genetics of cannabis. And I can say on good authority that the scientific facts are such that hemp and marijuana, although they are the same species, are very different beasts. And they are distinguished on the basis of drug content and genetics, and this bill distinguishes between them and creates the opportunity for drug enforcement to focus on its mission and for agriculture to focus on supplying a domestic demand for hemp products that can currently only be met by foreign importation. I had a presentation that I was prepared to deliver on the differences between hemp and marijuana and would be happy to elaborate on that. However, I understand we're short on time.
Let's see, Representative Emmer.
Thank you. For the witness, you testified that these are very different beasts. And yet, for some reason, in the bill, despite the fact that you want somebody not as sharp as I, or less as dumb as I am, to believe this has nothing to do with marijuana, and yet Section 26 of your bill on page 8 is an affirmative defense to a prosecution for the possession of marijuana. I mean, isn't this really just kind of a backdoor attempt to try and legalize an illegal drug, a gateway drug?
Representative Kahn?
Let me say, I have to ask that, first of all, we're not being pioneers in this. We're following the state of North Dakota, not quite as far or as fast. And I do always wish that I could morph myself into the chief proponent in North Dakota, who's Representative David Monson, who farms 10 miles from the Canada border in the northern part of the state, and who is also a Republican. He's a high school teacher. He's the president of his Lutheran church and so forth. And he's been working on this as long as I have. But what this specifically does is this specifically talks about the difference. And as I said, there was a slide presentation which specifically go into this. But, you know, Canada is able to do it, France is able to do it, and so forth. One of the issues is this is a few agricultural products which we could grow here, which we bring into the state in greater quantities from Canada and from other countries. So it's a good trade economic development issue. But there is no, you know, one person said at one point, if you wanted to get rid of any possibility of growing marijuana outside, the best thing you could do is just encourage fields of industrial hemp all over the place because it cross-pollinates and ruins the crop.
Dr. Wagland,
if I could speak to the question, is this bill an effort to open the door to marijuana legalization, and it is specifically not. And as Representative Kahn has said, if we are serious about enforcing marijuana, cracking down on marijuana cultivation, one of the best ways to do it is to encourage the cultivation of hemp, specifically because the pollen from hemp will spoil the street value of any marijuana crop. As anyone in the marijuana business knows, you cannot hide commercial marijuana in a hemp field. And this this bill creates the opportunity for farmers to stand up and produce a crop quite apart from marijuana.
So, Representative Kahn, in essence, this is your another anti-crime bill of yours this year?
Yeah.
What's going on, Representative Kahn? You've got at least two anti-crime bills this year. You've got two pro-business bills this year.
Well,
have you had your convention yet?
Thank you. I love the statement, as anyone in the marijuana business knows. I think really what Representative Kahn has brought before you is yet another jobs bill. But I was asked to you directly, and by the way, Representative Kahn, there are a lot of things that they do in North Dakota that we don't do here in Minnesota, and that we don't even talk about here in Minnesota. But the issue is, if this is a very different beast, then why do we need an affirmative defense for marijuana? This, let's be honest, this is just an attempt. You can call it what you want, an agricultural bill, a farming bill, a crime prevention bill, a jobs bill. This is nothing more than a backdoor attempt to allow people to possess cannabis in some form that can ultimately be marketed through the marijuana business. I mean, isn't that really what we're doing?
Just read through that section. You have one, if you do it to the provisions, that means the person will have licensed and registered and sold, given the DPS, looking at what's going on in Hawaii and North Dakota, the DPS area of where he's doing it. And so again, Dr. Weiberg can tell you how you can tell exactly what he's doing too. Because he's gotten, and if you also notice the effective dates of the bill, nothing goes into effect until the DEA has actually allowed it. North Dakota is taking the lead on trying to get the DEA to do it. So the defendant has a valid applicable. These are all ands. They're not ifs. They're not ors. So you have to have a valid license from DEA, and that they've registered and so forth, and that the substance is industrial hemp. Those aren't ors. They're all ands.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. We clearly disagree, but I think my biggest problem is just what you have noted. You are going to allow people to go out and get some license, and I have a feeling that our peace officers are going to take a big issue with, what do they do when they pull somebody over and they pull out one of these licenses and you can't prosecute them anyway? I think this is going to do exactly what my perspective is. It's not going to be the agricultural boom that, you know why people are doing this. That's all. I'll be quiet.
Mr. Chair?
I wanted to announce if there was anybody that wanted to testify against this. Okay. Representative Tulsa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment that it's my understanding that industrial hemp is not smokable. And it so if you do have, or you don't get the effect, if you do smoke industrial hemp, I guess. And so... So that's my understanding. So it wouldn't be, if someone had a license, even if they had industrial hemp with them, if they had regular marijuana with them, that license wouldn't be any good for it anyway.
So, Representative Hellstrom, if you're running for president and you say you didn't inhale, you don't have to say
I never have, never did, never will. I didn't even know what it smelled like until I took my local police chief took us on a tour of
our police, of our one of our apartment complexes that we're having difficulty with in our community, and I smelled it in the hall. That was the first time I'm like, what is that?
So. That's the one across from Pizza Hut?
Yes, that's the one across from Pizza Hut.
I think everybody knows that one. Why don't we let the opposition have a shot? Well, we can go because we're going down the line.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm Bob Bushman, the President of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. I'm also a 26-year narcotics officer.
Bushman?
Bushman, yes, sir, B-U-S-H-M-A-N.
When I represented them, that was, oh, no, it was Birch, that's right, it wasn't Bush, sorry.
Go ahead. All right. I agree wholeheartedly with Representative Emmer. This is nothing more than a play out of the normal playbook to open the door for legalization of drugs in Minnesota. To respond to Representative Hillstrom's comment about smoking hemp versus smoking marijuana, hemp is marijuana. It looks like it. It smells like it. It grows like it. A police officer on the street isn't going to be able to tell the difference from one to the other. Hemp contains THC. Right in your bill, you're limiting the THC level of hemp at 0.3 tenths of a percent to make the distinguishment between making something, the same thing, legal and illegal. Going back to looking at the bill under Section 19, it says that the legislature finds that the development and use of industrial hemp can improve the state's economy and agricultural vitality. When it was legal in Canada, it was grown. There's no market for it. They had silos and piles full of hemp looking for a market. And back when this came up during the Governor Ventura days, they were hoping that Minnesota was going to legalize it and move it down here so they had a place to ship that product for somebody to produce it. Representative Kahn talked about Hawaii. The permit that was issued in Hawaii expired because they couldn't find any investors to put money into the project to promote or to synthesize the hemp into product. North Dakota, I'm not aware that they've even received their permit from the DEA yet. I'm a farm kid, I have farm families, and I know what the price of farm land is, I know what rent is going for, and I'm sure you all know what's going on with farm commodities right now. The corn, the soybeans, and wheat is an all-time high. There isn't any farmer in his right mind that's going to go to the banks that are needed to secure the property, to secure the land, to meet the qualifications for a permit, spend that kind of money when they can make much more money growing legal subsidized crops in its place.
Yes.
Again, law enforcement, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, the State Narcotics Association, the State Sheriff's Association, and the State Chiefs of Police oppose this legislation because we look at it as nothing more than an attempt to open the door to legalize illegal drugs.
Representative De La Force, I think we want to give this a fair treatment, and so we've reserved, we have the basement, and then we've got one more bill, and we can't be laying them over at this, we're too late in the session. So I think what we'll do is recess for like 2 minutes so that we can move from here to the downstairs so we can hear the rest of the next committee is already moving in, and they get very surly if we're in here over time. So. We're going to recess, and please everybody take this bill and my 2696 downstairs with you to the basement. Committee's recessed for a few minutes.
Mr. Bushman, I wasn't aware. Were you finished or
almost? I just have one more.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From a public safety standpoint, there's one other problem that I see with this legislation, and that's in under Section 18K, Subdivision 3. What you're doing is you're changing the legal definition of marijuana from marijuana to hemp. The problem this causes is when police officers seize and find marijuana out in the field, which they do every day, which they do quite regularly. That's also going to require additional monies and additional effort into testing to determine whether or not the marijuana seized, whether it's in baggies, whether it's in marijuana cigarettes, whether it's in bulk quantity, is actually hemp or marijuana. and now you're creating a legal distinction which separates one from another by having it having to meet the threshold of 0.3% of THC. Because there is no discernible way for any police officer on the street to look at a sample of marijuana to determine its potency or distinguish the difference between marijuana and hemp, which would put a great burden on our state crime labs and any local laboratories that are involved in that type of testing.
Well, Mr. Bushman, just comes to mind, what if, can a street officer tell the difference, and I don't know much about the drugs, but could a street officer tell the difference between certain substances that aren't a drug immediately from looking at them? I've heard from cops that say they can't tell the difference between some drugs and imitations that are sold on the street.
You can tell the difference between some, but when it comes to marijuana, the only way to have to know the potency is to have it tested in the laboratory. You can't tell that with the naked eye. But like cocaine, you can tell cocaine from other substances, but you don't know what the potency level is, whether it's 20% or whether it's 90%. Here, where you're creating a distinction, saying that anything 0.3% or less is hemp, and anything over is marijuana, that's not, that information isn't available to the officer. He's going to field test that they're both going to field test positive, telling the officer on the street that they're both contain THC and that they're both marijuana.
Representative Lutz.
Thank you. My question for you is that routinely, when I get police reports that I read as prosecutor in St. Paul, that always comes through with a marijuana charge they've done, and I don't know how you pronounce it, but Dunequois, whatever, D-U-N-E-Q-U-O-I-S, where you put the substance on and it turns purple, it's got THC in it. Are you telling me that hemp is going to test positive in the same way as marijuana would for that kind of test?
With the screening test, Mr. Bush, the possibility is that it will, yes, sir.
Okay, Representative Lash.
Possibly, what do you mean? What do you mean,
Mr. Bush?
Possibly.
Representative Lash, if there's THC present in the sample, which there would be in hemp, you should get a positive indication, yes. The field test does not distinguish between potency. It just shows you whether or not the chemical of the drug being tested for is present.
Representative LaFleur.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I had a question for Mr. Bushman. Perhaps we can go back to the professor for some of these technical questions. But, sir, you and Representative Emmer essentially questioned the motives of the author, which is fine, you can do that in committee, but you essentially have stated that this bill is about legalizing marijuana. It's not really about hemp and industrial hemp production. So I'd like you to share with me in the committee upon what basis you make the statement that Representative Kahn is merely interested in legalizing marijuana.
Yes, sir, I'd be glad to. Representative De La Forest, Mr. Chair. I have watched the legalization efforts in other states and initiatives around the country, and in many places this is how it starts. If you go back to my earlier testimony about the state's economy and agricultural vitality, if you take the time to research the hemp legislation and the hemp initiatives in other states, you'll find that just about every state that's had that has, on their own, gone into some research and some research and some study about the viability of hemp, whether or not there's actually a market for it, whether or not there's an industry for it, whether or not there's a want or a desire for it. And in all of those studies I have seen, the states have determined that they're not going to move forward with hemp because there is a very, very limited market. It is not there's no vitality, and it displaces other commodities, other crops, and other subsidized crops, and really can have a negative effect on the agricultural development.
Well, and Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bushman, that's wonderful to speak in generalities about what's happened in other jurisdictions. I was asking specifically about Representative Kahn because, to the best of my knowledge, in serving here for 6 years, she's authored no bill to legalize marijuana. So I'm kind of curious that you impugn her integrity directly in that in general. And more than that, it seems to me that questions about farmers and whether or not this is economically viable, that's a question for the legislature and ultimately the free market to make. Each individual should decide who owns a plot of agricultural land, whether or not they're going to grow corn, soybeans, or hemp, or the like.
My final question, Mr. Bushman, I had is, in other, what other states have examined or even passed industrial hemp laws that have also gone on to legalize the possession of marijuana for recreational purposes?
Representative DeLaForest, right off the top of my head, I couldn't name those for you.
Right.
I don't have my papers with me.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bushman, Representative DeLaForest brought up something that I should have, as chair, said something about earlier, about questioning the motives of a member here, and I really think you should retract your statement accusing Representative Kahn. We may think that Phyllis is off in her own world at times, but
Mr. Chairman,
she certainly should not be accused of that, I don't think.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that was my statement. It wasn't intended to impugn anyone's integrity. Representative Kahn may believe that there's some interest in hemp production, but as the testimony has shown, if there is no market for hemp, then what other purpose would there be for creating a law that in effect creates an affirmative defense for the possession of the very drug that we're concerned with? So it was my statement, and Representative Kahn, you have my sincere apology if it suggested in any way a question on your credibility or your integrity. My apologies.
Thank you for clearing that up.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bush.
Nor was it my intention to impugn the integrity of Phyllis Kahn, Representative Kahn. But as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this. I've seen where this has been before. I was here during the medical marijuana fight that we had last year, which, you know, Representative Kahn was on the other side of that also. And it is my opinion, and I guess that I am in disagreement with some of the folks here, that this is more of an attempt to legalize drugs than it is to provide for economic development in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Lowy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and sorry, Mr. Bushman. Mr. Bushman?
Yes, yeah, sir.
Thank you. I'm one of the co-authors on the medical marijuana bill, and I, you know, I've had a lot of people that I know in my life with cancer, and I think you're flat wrong on that, sir. You know, there's nothing about trying to legalize, you know, for the general public. That is not at all what I signed on to on that bill or effort. There's no one doing that. There's not even, it's not even remotely close to the truth. I myself have been chemical free for 20 years, and at the same time, but I very much support this effort for people that are suffering with cancer, for example, or other health issues. And I think you're really mistaken on that effort. But I don't see this as a big problem. I have up in my office, I have a product that I got from the kids had gone to a tanning booth thing, and it's you know, one of the products that is an offshoot of this is a lotion, and they have, you know, it says hemp lotion. I thought it was kind of funny, so I brought it down to my office here, and I have it up in my desk. I don't really, you know, I've used it on my hands. I've smells good, thank you, which is true. I've had comments to that fact, and but I don't think I'm getting high from it, and I don't think it's a big public safety threat, but you know, I don't think this is going to impede law enforcement's efforts, and I think we need to do what we can to make Minnesota stronger. And just going back to the medical marijuana, I hope Phyllis Kahn is planning on bringing it forward again. And oh, okay, Mr. Hunley, sorry. But, thank you.
I'd like a roll call, Mr. Chairman.
I have a question of somebody. Isn't hemp used for a lot of clothing? I thought that I one time had a hat made out of hemp or something, or a cap or something. Representative Kahn?
Chairman, I didn't think I was going to speak to the economics of hemp. I do have several articles, including one from last year from The Economist on the hemp industry. I will point out that one of the national Republican candidates for president is in favor of the legalization of industrial hemp. And I think you need to read the bill to know before you can grow industrial hemp, you got to go through this whole licensing procedure. You know, you're picked up on the street and you don't have your license and you don't have the, you know, you haven't gone through that whole thing. That's, you're not, you don't have industrial hemp because that's how we defined it. The other point is that we, if you look at the effective date on the bill, we made any of the effective, you know, any of the ones that would lead to the growing of it in the state effective on essentially a license being given. So we're looking at the North Dakota state, either the DEA being forced by the court or deciding by themselves that it's going to be allowed. I know what happened in Hawaii because there was another Republican legislator who was working on that issue there. So James had a Democrat working on it in Minnesota. But essentially the restrictions that were put up around the field were sort of like a minimum security visit. And they had enough to do an experimental plot, but there was no way, if every farm that had corn and soybeans had to have security of a minimum security prison, you wouldn't see a lot of that being done. But nothing happened until the Fed, all this does is put Minnesota in position to move when the federal law is changed. The federal law will have to change before that. And we join our neighbors in North Dakota, and I can have Professor Wiseman can say some more about the enforcement issue.
Representative Hunt, I think we will. I wanted to vent this bill fully, but we have another testifier, I believe, against. You're against the bill, aren't you?
I am. I'm opposed to this bill.
Would you state your name? And
I will. I'm Rebecca Howell, and I'm a sergeant with the Wright County Sheriff's Department. I have spent the past 15 years working in narcotics enforcement in the state of Minnesota. Just a little history. We are opposed to this type of agricultural hemp. I was born and raised on a farm, continue to reside on a farm. Farming is kind of in my blood, and I don't see this as a viable farm commodity for Minnesota farmers at this point in time. In the 1990s, we were pretty active in the cannabis suppression programs, so we were going out and eradicating a lot of these wild hemp fields that were existing throughout Minnesota. And the reason we were active in that is because oftentimes we'd have many youth that would go out there, steal these plants, harvest them, they were selling them, and they're involved in the use of smoking these types of plants. In 1998, I received a phone call from the Wright County narcotics agents when I was working in western Minnesota, and they said, Becky, you need to go out and take care of that marijuana field north of Dassel. And they gave me directions to it, and so the following morning I went out there, I assessed the situation, and that wild hemp that was growing out there was about 40,000 plants. Much to my dismay, that's a lot of time. You had to put a lot of work into eradicating those types of programs. The National Guard came out and assisted us in eradicating that field. But because of the cannabis suppression program, we're required to, you know, take samples of these plants and submit them to the BCA, who in turn submitted them to the University of Mississippi. And after about 2 months, when the test results came back, I got a call from one of the BCA agents and said, where did you get that marijuana you submitted? From those 40,000 plants, I don't know, I took those down from, like, in the valley part of where this land was. And they said, no, seriously, where did you get this? I'm like, from that grow out there, where else would I get it from? And they said, do you realize that that marijuana out there, that's 7.9% THC content, which is, it was rather high. I think with, you know, a lot of the farm runoff, I mean, I think that the hemp down there got some pretty good, you know, chemicals and some pretty good fertilizers that, you know, boosted it. So we do have a concern about this type of legislation passing. As a narcotics agent, I have investigated people who have had marijuana growing out in and amongst their cornfields. I mean, people are very clever with this. It would be very easy for somebody who is raising this as industrial hemp to also, you know, have several rolls of high-grade marijuana planted within the industrial hemp.
Representative Lush.
Thanks. And I missed the first part of the testimony.
Oh, I'm sorry, I went out of order.
Okay.
Sorry. Representative Cornish, I guess.
Mr. Chair, members, three things. I guess first a couple technical questions. Where is it going to go from here, and is there a fiscal note? And then the third thing is, I just want the committee members to remember that how many is millions. I don't know if it's tens of millions or hundreds of millions we spent in the Drug Task Force and poured money into drug detection and enforcement. And this will really complicate, no matter what your issue is about medical marijuana or how much harm it can do, for all the bad that it will do and the confusion it will create and the problem for law enforcement weighed against the minimal impact it will have for the economic success. I just want you to think about that before you vote. And then the other two, fiscal note and the path it's taking from here?
It goes to government operations.
Will that ever come back to Chairman Tamar or not?
It would be up to, I suppose, Representative Carlson would be the one that would decide that, I believe.
Thank you.
And what was the other question? Oh, fiscal note. Okay. Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, it wasn't relating to task force and stuff like that. I was just asking, I maybe didn't catch it in testimony, Representative Kahn. How many other states have this?
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's about, can I get
Mr. Weiblin, or do you want Was that 11?
11.
Okay. Representative Kahn?
I can just say, again, if you read the bill, you don't get to grow industrial hemp unless you said where you're going to grow it. You've applied for the license. You've given the probably when the rules come out, the GPS coordinates. You can't. And the act of defense is only if you got through that process. There aren't a lot of legal ill people doing illegal activities who would really want to do that.
Representative Lesch.
And so that law enforcement needs if they're trying to hide it. You go to the one or two licenses, you go right there and you just look. Much easier than having to people on the
thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for the officer from Wright County. We found that big old grow of dope out there, which actually is...
And I'd like you to know that was in Napier County at the time.
Oh, okay.
I was working in Western Minnesota, so...
Be careful. Be careful.
I would explain a lot.
Don't you go after my cops now. Stop that.
So 7.9%. THC in the hemp that you found, right?
Correct.
What's the average amount of THC in hemp versus the average amount of THC in marijuana? And I know there's a wide variation, BC, bud, or whatever, higher content rate, but what is there a wide disparity or what's the measuring?
There is a wide disparity of THC content, and the only way to analyze it to know what the THC content is to submit it to a laboratory for specific testing.
Okay, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But my question is, if I'm getting a truckload of what appears to be the DC bud, is it like 50% THC? And you're like, oh, it's marijuana. And if you get hemp, is it standard 2%? How do you eyeball that?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch. Oh. What did you say? Getting a truckload of what?
DC bud.
What, Mr. Chairman, what is DC bud?
Those of us in the know are very familiar with DC bud. No. I'm sure the testifiers can testify that, Mr. Chair, but it's British Columbia, higher concentrated kind of marijuana.
Representative Howell. I'm not Ms. Howell. I think there was a question a while ago for you.
If I understand that question correctly, you're asking me how do I differentiate or tell what the THC content is? Looking at that, or what's the question?
My question is, thank you, Mr. Chair. What would be a line for you? Because I have no idea the standard amount of THC in a marijuana plant versus the standard amount of THC in a hemp plant. Are you able to tell me general difference? 30% to 2%, 70% to 6%. What's the difference?
Ms. Howell.
A hemp plant would be 0.3% THC content, but according to 0.03% THC content. However, I can't determine that. According to Minnesota law, federal law, any amount of THC is illegal to possess that plant.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the second part of my question would be a marijuana plant. What percentage generally, if you saw this was marijuana or this was a standard high-quality street product marijuana, what would you generally see as THC content in there, percentage? Ms. Hall.
It varies. It can be anywhere from 3 to 35% THC. I mean, it just depends on how the person is grooming that plant, how they're caring for it, and what strain or breed of plant they're dealing with.
Okay. Representative Hall.
Representative Khan, you wanted to have some... Okay, Mr. Weibland, would you come up so we can have a mic for you?
Okay,
Mr. Weibland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kurt Weibland again, University of Minnesota, Department of Plant Biology. And I've been anxiously sitting in the audience listening to the testimony and would like to appeal to my colleagues in law enforcement to accept the evidence over conjecture and hearsay regarding cannabis. And I can answer the questions regarding potency, regarding the variation that one sees that is to some extent based on genetics and to some extent based on the environment, but I can tell you on good authority that we have found in our research, not just mine, but research internationally, that tetrahydrocannabinol, the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis, is the product of a biochemical pathway controlled by a single gene. Depending on which switch, depending on this genetic switch, whether it's on or off, one has a very different plant chemically, and that chemistry is independent of the environment in which the plant is grown. It's genetic. There is no way that a Minnesota hemp plant took up more nutrients and suddenly became 7.9% THC. That is impossible. This would have to be a circumstance in which someone was feeding a marijuana crop. I can tell you that when this genetic switch is on, plants range from 2% to 25% THC content dry weight. And that highly potent, that high-grade cannabis that's on the market today, the BC Bud as it's called, is the product of selective breeding by marijuana breeders around the world to push potency up. Hemp breeders, on the other hand, have pushed potency down. When this genetic switch is off, the plants range from 0.3% on down to 0.001% below the levels of detection by the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And in the course of research that's going on now, we're in the process of manipulating these genetic switches to produce plants that have no cannabinoids at all, that have distinctive morphological features such that any officer would be able to distinguish, for instance, a hemp plant with spotted leaves that would be a registered variety of cannabis, specifically registered with authorities for the purpose of hemp cultivation that could be quite different. These registered varieties don't exist now, of course, because under the Controlled Substances Act, there is no distinction made between cultivars of cannabis, although they're very different in terms of their agricultural and economic uses. And the evidence is in favor of hemp being economically viable. I can tell you that Nativa Corporation in California they cleared $4 million in profit last year in their hemp food products. The area cultivated in Canada has expanded year by year. There were some ups and downs in the market in the 90s, but if you look at data provided by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we see exponentially increasing acreage in hemp in Canada.
Okay, we're going to have to kind of move on. Mr. Dole, I'm just going to try Dolish. That's the closest I can from the BCA.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Frank Dolish. Very good. From the BCA laboratory.
I just want to speak to one element of this bill, and that is the change of the definition of marijuana so that it would not include industrial hemp. And what that means, and that would take effect the day that you pass this bill. This wouldn't be something that would be held off until somebody can grow it. On passage of this bill, in order to be able to determine whether or not something meets the definition of marijuana, it will have to be tested in a laboratory to determine that the level of THC is above the level that's set in this bill. This may be an unintended outcome of what we're trying, what the Representative Kahn is trying to do with this bill, but that would mean, and we will have to put a fairly significant fiscal note on this bill because of what it will do to the laboratories around the state.
So then, Mr. Dolish, you're saying that this would have a fiscal note and would have to go to finance, then. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Congratulations, Michael. you get this all over. Okay, unless there's any more questions. I can't remember, but there's a roll call on it. So we don't do an oral. Clerk will take the roll.
No.
Representative Bigham.
No.
Representative Cornish.
No.
Representative De La Forest.
Yes.
Representative Emmer.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
Okay.
Representative Holberg. Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Cowan.
No.
Representative Cole. Representative Krantz.
Yes.
Representative Lesh.
Aye.
Representative Lilly.
Yes.
Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Paymar.
Yes.
Representative Saylor. Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith. Representative Westrom. Representative Mueller, excuse me.
Aye.
Thank you.
It passes 7-5.
Thank you very much.
Yes, that was.
Members, we have one more bill before us. House File 2696 is Chair Mullery's bill. We'll try to proceed as quickly as we can. Chair Mullery, would you like to move House File 2696 with a recommendation to pass?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And proceed to finance with further recommendation to proceed to public safety finance?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The officer from Minneapolis apparently had to leave after we moved down, but we have an officer from St. Paul. Mr. Chairman, can I proceed?
Chair Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. The state requires the notices that were set up back in the early 90s for level 3 sex offenders when they move into communities. And this causes an extra burden on local communities. Not only, this is an addition to the huge burden on the communities, because in most cases these sex offenders aren't from those communities that they move into. And so that often has problems, but then on top of that, then the state is requiring them to pay for the cost that really the state should have, since they're requiring this this state. And I don't even know. Gray? Officer Gray from St. Paul can explain what the city has to go through and what she has to go through.
Welcome to the committee, Officer Gray. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Hi, I'm Sherry Gray, G-R-A-Y, and I'm the commander of the Family and Sexual Violence Unit for the St. Paul Police Department. And we're responsible for the notification meetings for level 3 sex offenders. In St. Paul, for instance, we have 900 sex offenders, and there's only a small percentage which are level 3, and the level 3 require a meeting any time they move or any time they're released from the Department of Corrections. And last year we had a total of 7 meetings in Minneapolis. They told John Hinchcliffe, who was supposed to be here, said he had over 100. Unfortunately, the meetings for level 3 plus the mailings for level 2 and level 1, we have to mail out to daycare centers as is listed in there, a certain block radius, which we do. We do a public service phone message. For the level 3, we work with our district councils. We're fortunate enough to do that because we are a bigger city, and we have more of them, so it's a little bit easier for us as it would be some of the smaller departments, the sheriff's offices. It would be difficult to put together all those resources. And even for us, it's very resource intensive. There's a financial burden. You know, we have to find a central location for the meeting. We have to distribute flyers. We have to speak to the Department of Corrections and ask them what specifically this offender offended from and create that kind of information so we can speak at the meetings on behalf of what specifically the habits of this person and what to look for and safety tips. And it costs us roughly about $1,700 for a level 3 meeting, and a lot of that is postage, flyering, salaries, working with the council. And last year, you know, 1,700 times 7, that's going to add up. And then too, with our level 2 and our level 1, also there's a huge financial burden for us also. We do believe in this, and you know, we continue to do this even without the funding. But it would definitely help for smaller agencies in particular, and for agencies like us where we are taking people off the streets, cops off the streets, to start working and doing these type of things. So.
Thank you, Officer Gray. Any questions from members? Anybody? Representative Lush.
As a member from St. Paul, I want to thank Commander Gray for all the work you do on this. I regularly try to attend as many of these meetings as I can. And as you're aware, the citizens in different neighborhoods feel differently about it. And in my neighborhood, with the concentration of level 3s, the citizens are inundated with these notices constantly. And it's yeoman's work to have to go out and do this every single time for the same guy that moves 2 blocks away and then gets kicked out and moves 2 blocks again. So I just wanted to put that on the record. Thank you for your work for doing that.
Representative Tamar.
I didn't have a question of the officer, but I want one of the Department of Corrections. I see they're coming up to address the cost of this.
Thank you, Representative Tamar. It would be great to hear from the department. Thank you, Commander Gray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ken Mers. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections, and I just have a couple quick comments on this bill. First of all, the department has absolutely no problem with this bill. We would certainly be willing to administer a reimbursement program for the cost of the local units of government for community notification. However, I do have to point out we have no budget for this. We have no line item in our budget to cover this. And we have done some preliminary work with as far as the cost would go, and the estimates that we've gotten have ranged anywhere from $35 for an incident, And when I say incident, I mean it could be a level 1, level 2, level 3 notification. A notification would be an incident. Up to $9,000 in one of the larger suburban areas. And so when you look at the bill and it talks about reimbursing all costs, certainly a legitimate cost would be the cost to the department for their time. And so we're talking overtime, we're talking salary for the officers involved. Several of the larger jurisdictions have full-time staff that work strictly on the community notification issue, so legitimately their time would also be reimbursable. So this could have a very, very significant dollar assignment to it, and it would need to be looked at. And we appreciate Representative Mullery referring this on to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Mers. Any other questions from members? Anyone in the audience wish to testify either for or against the bill? Seeing none, all those, Chair Mullery renews his motion that House Bill 2696 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Finance with a further recommendation to re-refer to Public Safety Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and I believe our business is done and the meeting is adjourned.